Good evening. The Supreme Court hears oral arguments in a case concerning the right not to be an informant. Donald Trump's epic return to the White House falls flat, and more bad news as the coronavirus rears its head in New York City. With these and other stories, I'm Paul D'Arienzo with the WBAI News for Tuesday, October 6th. 2020. The Russian government issued a new appeal for an end to hostilities in and around Nagorno-Karabakh on Tuesday after Moscow's foreign intelligence chief said the mountain enclave could become a launchpad for Islamist militants to enter Russia. The last 10 days have seen the deadliest fighting in more than a quarter century between the armed forces of Armenia and Azerbaijan. The Armenian-held area, surrounded by Azerbaijan, saw a civil war in the early 1990s that killed about 30,000 people. The new fighting, beginning in September, has increased concern that Turkey and Russia could be sucked into the South Caucasus conflict. Russia has a mutual defense pact with Armenia. Iran, which shares a border with both countries, is also worried about the conflict. Syrian leader Bashar al-Assad blamed Turkish President Tayyip Erdogan for being the main instigator and the initiator of the conflict, a charge Turkey has termed dark propaganda. And United States Secretary of State Mike Pompeo visited Japan on Tuesday to rally support from Washington's closest allies in Asia. Pompeo is calling for Japan, India, and Australia to unite with the United States against what he called China's growing regional influence. Pompeo's visit was supposed to include trips to Mongolia and South Korea, but was cut back to one day after President Trump was diagnosed with COVID-19. And in Washington, United States Supreme Court Chief Justice opened today's session of the court with a eulogy for Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg before hearing oral arguments in the case named, that's Tanzeen versus Tanvir. Mohammed Tanvir and two other Muslim men filed suit arguing they were placed on the no-fly list because they wouldn't become informants for the FBI for religious reasons. Rebecca Miles has more on the story.
Oral arguments were heard at the United States Supreme Court on Tuesday in the case Tanvir versus Tanzin, with attorneys urging the court to uphold a ruling that the men may sue FBI agents for interfering with their freedom to practice their religion when they were placed on no-fly lists after refusing to be informants. The case began in 2011 when the lead plaintiff, Mohammed Tanvir, contacted the Center for Constitutional Rights, who then started hearing similar tales from other American Muslim men. Dyla Shamas.
The agents told them that they wanted them to spy generally on their Muslim communities. And then to coerce or to flip them, the FBI resorted to a powerful tool in their toolbox, their ability to place someone on the no-fly list.
Once played on the no-fly list, the men were unable to fly to their homes in Afghanistan, Yemen, or Pakistan to see their grandparents and parents. They lost jobs and were stigmatized within their own communities. The men sued to be removed from the list after years of being unable to fly. And just before a major hearing in the case, the government told them they were no longer on the list. A judge then dismissed the remaining portion of the lawsuit, which sought damages for the emotional and financial harm the men had suffered. But a federal appeals court reinstated the case. The Trump administration appealed to the Supreme Court. The number of people on the no-fly list rises and falls, but figures from 2013 suggest it was 47,000. And the terror watch list for those suspected of involvement with terrorism as of 2016 was said to consist of over 1.9 million people. Rebecca Miles, WBAI Pacifica Radio, New York.
In the case will be issued in June 2021. And President Trump is still spreading concern and possibly the coronavirus after his dramatic return from Walter Reed Hospital last night after being admitted with symptoms of COVID-19. He's still sick, and the White House seems pretty empty, with many of his coworkers also sick. But he says he feels great and that the drugs he was administered worked well, and a vaccine is coming momentarily.
I didn't feel so good. And 2 days ago, I could have left 2 days ago. 2 days ago, I felt great, like better than I have in a long time. I said just recently, better than 20 years ago. Don't let it dominate. Don't let it take over your lives. Don't let that happen. We're the greatest country in the world. We're going back. We're going back to work. We're going to be out front. As your leader, I had to do that. I knew there's danger to it, but I had to do it. I stood out front. I led. Nobody that's a leader would not do what I did. And I know there's a risk, there's a danger, but that's okay. And now I'm better, and maybe I'm immune, I don't know. But don't let it dominate your lives. Get out there, be careful. We have the best medicines in the world, and it all happened very shortly, and they're all getting approved, and the vaccines are coming momentarily.
Although several vaccines are in the works, few outside of Trump's circle are confident a shot is coming before the November 3rd election, despite billions in government money turned over to a handful of big pharmaceutical companies. The director of the NGO Ecology International Foundation is James Love. He says Bill Gates and his foundation are responsible for privatizing research on the vaccine that should be in the public domain.
There's one contingent that thinks that there should be weaker intellectual property rights, more open sourcing of technology. There should be more measures taken to challenge monopolies in drugs and vaccine space if they think prices are excessive or if there's big access problems or if there's a lot of government funding of the inventions to begin with. The Gates Foundation, and Bill Gates in particular, on the other hand, has taken the opposite view. He's tended to see that strong monopolies are a good thing. He defends strong intellectual property rights and a big presence by companies, even when the underlying technology is funded by governments.
Is that because he's a money-hungry capitalist, or he thinks it'll just work better that way?
Johnson & Johnson, Moderna, AstraZeneca, all these companies, the governments are just throwing money at them. So you privatize the goods at the end of the day. With Bill, it's ideological for him. He just believes that the granting of monopolies and patents are really always a good thing, that you should not really challenge the grant of the monopoly. You should negotiate and talk to the companies. And that's the end of the story. And a lot of us are very uncomfortable with that, particularly in this particular pandemic, when the companies that are developing the vaccines are by and large working on government-funded technology. In some cases, 100%. In other cases, it's partial funding. And none of them have the capacity to supply the vaccine to all the people that need it. And so we think that the scale-up of the delivery of the vaccine would go faster if they were open sourcing all the technology. And we also think the prices would be lower and more people would have access to the vaccines.
How does open sourcing work?
If you want to knock off a small molecule, it's not that challenging compared to a vaccine. Vaccine is tough. For this to work properly, what you'd expect the vaccine manufacturers to do is to be at a very early time and not waiting, sharing technical information on what the manufacturing processes are and providing other manufacturers with access to the cell lines. In fact, that's actually happening within some of the companies, what we've been referred to as the cartel. So there are some production sharing agreements between companies where one company that develops a vaccine has already entered into an agreement that another company can manufacture the same vaccine if it's approved in order to scale up the manufacturing faster. In order to do that, they already have the agreements in place and the structures in place to do technology transfer. And that includes know-how, access to the cell lines, and it also includes access to whatever rights they have in patents and data. Now, that's taking place to a limited extent, and we think it should be not limited to these sort of small number of companies and not have the private companies making as many decisions about this. We think there should be the public should have more say on how this is done.
I thought that a vaccine development, you needed a giant laboratory.
It's not something that anyone can do. The capacity is probably broader than you would imagine. Also, the scale of some of this manufacturing is not probably as big as you think. Some of the new manufacturing technologies they have, for some vaccines, you're going to see more potential capacity as possible. Them that have manufacturing capacity in their backyard, they're going to have a better shot at having access than countries that don't. If you think this is a one-off, then okay, fine. But if you think this is maybe going to persist for a while, or if you think this is not the last pandemic we're going to see, maybe it's historically been a mistake to have as much concentration as we've seen in the manufacturing capacity of vaccine. They didn't used to really be like that, and it's evolved over time. What we'd like to see is more of a deliberate effort to build up the capacity of different manufacturers in different parts of the world as well to manufacture vaccines. One of the reasons why it should be happening right now is just the amount of money that's being thrown at the manufacturers. The U.S. government is paying companies to build factories. It's paying for the preclinical research. It's paying for clinical trials. It's paying for everything. And then it's offering to buy the vaccines if they work. So the amount of public sector funding, not just in the United States, but in Germany, in Israel and Italy, in the UK and other countries is pretty extensive right now. And because of that, we'd like to see the governments using our money design this in a way that benefits the public more. And I think what you're seeing is that the policies have been designed to protect the commercial interest of companies more than the public.
The director of the NGO Ecology International Foundation is James Love. And Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden was at Gettysburg, Pennsylvania today, the site of one of the bloodiest battles in American history, pitting the Union Army against the Confederates. The Union won, the story goes, and Joe Biden didn't want President Trump to forget it.
Too many Americans seek not to overcome our divisions, but to deepen them. We must seek not to build walls, but bridges. We must seek not to have our fists clenched, but our arms open. We have to seek not to tear each other apart, but seek to come together. You don't have to agree with me on everything, or even on most things, to see that we're experiencing today is neither good nor normal.
And that's presidential candidate Joe Biden. Back at the White House, after a dramatic helicopter return from the military hospital where he was receiving an unprecedented level of care for COVID-19, Trump's attitude alarmed infectious disease experts, and it suggested his own illness had not caused him to rethink his often cavalier attitude towards the disease, which has also infected the First Lady and more than a dozen White House aides and associates. Anxious to project strength just 4 weeks from Election Day, Trump, who is still contagious with the virus, tweeted Tuesday morning that he's planning to attend next week's debate with Democrat Joe Biden in Miami. It will be great, he said. Lawyer and former Judge Bill Blum says Trump's actions may be making the president
states to extortion, bribery, obstruction of Congress, obstruction of criminal investigations, witness tampering, perjury, delaying the delivery of mail, violating campaign finance law, and of course the big one that's been promoted by people like Glenn Kirshner, involuntary manslaughter in his handling of the COVID-19 epidemic. And then on the New York front, you have such possible offenses as falsifying business records, tax and insurance fraud, and conspiracy to commit the same. So there's a real laundry list of possibilities that Donald Trump is facing. And I think this is a serious concern for him.
I see. Now, there's only been one other president who's been arrested.
Yes, yes. I do go over that rather comical incident involving Ulysses S. Grant in 1872, who was arrested for driving his carriage through the streets of Georgetown at an excessive speed. Apart from that, I'm aware of no other arrests. Of course, we know that Richard Nixon was named as an unindicted co-conspirator in the Watergate scandal, but no charges were brought against him, and he was pardoned.
It was obvious that the president of the United States was trying to obstruct justice. It was obvious. Everybody knew it. How come there was no, do you think there was no at least unindicted co-conspirator charge there?
If you read the DOJ policy memoranda, one from the Watergate era and one from 2000 that say you can't indict a sitting president, it's really for the good of the country. That's the rationale they give, that they don't want the executive branch of the federal government to be disrupted during a president's term.
And the 25th Amendment, people are saying that the 25th Amendment should be called. What's that and what would happen there?
The 25th Amendment allows for the president to be replaced on an involuntary basis. But that's never been utilized, and it's really hard for it to be utilized. And basically, it's very complicated, actually. But the most basic way to trigger it would be for the vice president to get the approval of a majority of the cabinet to declare that the president is incapable of performing his duties. There are other provisions of the Constitution that do that as well, or when the president is incapacitated. In our history, presidents have voluntarily ceded authority to the vice president when they've undergone surgery, for example. But it has never been invoked against the will of a president, and a president can veto a move made by the vice president and the cabinet together with congressional ratification. So the president can veto that, and then that would have to be met with an override of a veto, which is really, really hard to do. So I don't think the 25th Amendment is a viable mechanism at this stage for restraining Donald Trump.
And that's Bill Blum. He's a former judge and a lawyer, and his article is available in the Progressive magazine, the print edition of the Progressive. And revolutionary anti-Trump activist Carl Dick says, even though Trump is sinking fast in the polls, the election may not be the place where Trump's fate is ultimately decided. If thousands don't turn out to protest, he feels there might be a coup.
It was like the Führer portraying himself as conquering the virus, and the message being, keep me in power and I will continue to conquer for you, while 200,000 plus people in this country have died, 7 million plus have been infected, the refusal to accept peaceful transfer of power, devastation of the environment and all the rest. It underscores why Refuse Fascism has launched day after day protests raising the demand, Trump Pence out now. People need to take to the streets and stay in the streets as part of driving this regime from power. Here in New York, people are out 6 p.m. every weekday in Union Square is where they step off from. On the weekends, it's 2 p.m.
His support is collapsing across the country in every single segment except one, where it's growing: white men without a college education. And he's trailing 12-15% in some key states like Pennsylvania.
Not surprising that white men are his strongest base of support.
But white men without a college, it's key though, white men without a college degree.
Okay, white men without a college degree, it points to possibilities for him to lose and lose big in an election. But that's not the crucial thing, because he has his plans to take a losing election into the courts, to refuse to go along with it, to get it jammed up until it gets to the Supreme Court. And then he is hoping that putting this next Christian fascist on the court will ensure that that will be an election that he wins. He is planning on refusing to leave. People in the streets are going to be an important part of creating a situation where that refusal can be overwhelmed.
You think it's a coup? It's a coup. He might launch.
A rolling coup. He's actually laying it out. Why do you refuse to accept a peaceful transfer of power? Well, you're saying you ain't getting me out of here unless you're ready to throw down. And he is sure that his base, even though it's not a majority of the country, is determined to fight to keep him in. And is anybody else ready to go against him on that?
Those poor white racists really a big threat to America today?
Remember, those cops in Kenosha welcomed those white supremacist militia people. They were giving them water and telling them how glad they were that they were there. I think it's wrong to minimize the danger and the damage that this regime could do and just go with, well, the polls are going our way, we got this. If people slip back into that and think that that's going to take us across the finish line and get rid of this guy who never should have been in there. And he never should have been in there, but he did get in. And now the question is how we get him out. And that's why we're doing what we're doing, because we think we need more than just a ballot and a hope that he abides by it.
And Trump activist Carl Dix. And you're listening to the news on WBAI New York. I'm Paul DiRienzo. And New York City Mayor Bill de Blasio announced today that schools in several Brooklyn and Queens zip codes will be immediately closed, and the zip codes put on a new lockdown after several weeks of high COVID-19 positivity levels. He spoke today at City Hall.
And right now, again, we have 9 zip codes where we have seen the positivity level for the coronavirus above 3% for 7 consecutive days. It remains 9 zip codes. Then we have our watch list, and that's tier 2, where we're watching areas that are in danger of entering that top tier of particularly troubled zip codes. We have a new zip code we're adding to that watch list, and that is 11206 South Williamsburg. That brings the watch list total to 13. So again, we're staying stable with 9 in the top category where we need the most action, the most restrictions, 13 that are being watched. And those 13 do not need to end up in that top category. They do not need to experience those deeper restrictions. So you can see the number of days consecutive over 3%, thank God, not yet into that category. But we're warning people in those communities to really buckle down, to take all the right precautions, to take it seriously. You do not want to see these restrictions in your community. You can do something about it. You don't want to see small businesses closed in your neighborhood. You can do something about it. Right now, there is time to turn things around. That's why we're providing this information to the public in an urgent manner.
Mayor de Blasio and Governor Andrew Cuomo unveiled a complicated three-zone lockdown plan of his own on Tuesday to deal with the COVID clusters, and he slammed Mayor de Blasio, saying none of this would have been necessary if the city had enforced the law. It was day two of Cuomo criticizing de Blasio for having an ineffective plan to cope with COVID clusters, and so he threw up a plan that doesn't depend on zip codes but draws maps with different levels of rules. Governor Cuomo.
We have clusters where the viral infection rate is higher, about 3%, 4%. Where does the virus mainly transmit? Dr. Zucker was on the phone. We asked him that question. Schools, which are also the place where different communities come together, right? So my child goes to a private school, your child goes to a public school, but our children are on the same hockey team, or on the same soccer team, or they play together in the playground. Schools can be locations of transmissions. Religious gatherings, especially in these communities. New Rochelle, first hotspot, was an Orthodox Jewish man who went to a temple, hundreds of people, and then a wedding, hundreds of people. Orthodox Jewish gatherings often are very, very large. And we've seen what one person can do in a group. Look at this Rose Garden with the president, by the way. Outdoor event. Oh, those are safe, outdoor events. No, no, no. Safer than indoor. Nobody ever said safe. Safer than indoor. And look at that growing list of people at a presidential Rose Garden event who were theoretically tested before they came in. How many people could have been infected? One, two? And look at the spread in the Rose Garden. You know what happens here. You've seen it over and over again. Third of public spaces. These are basically in priority order. Fourth are businesses where consumers may interact, but that is way down on the list relatively. And the key to all of these areas is enforcement. All of them. We have rules for all these areas. We have rules for all these areas in place now. Well, then how's it increasing? Because people are not following the rules.
And that's Governor Cuomo. Mayor de Blasio, who has faced resistance to heavy-handed enforcement in the city, responded.
We've been doing enforcement for weeks and weeks. In fact, we've closed down businesses, closed down yeshivas, issued summonses, you name it. But what I think is clear here is this is a problem beyond the normal enforcement approach. This is a problem that requires larger restrictions for the community, because we tried in the past and had success in Sunset Park in Brooklyn, in Soundview in the Bronx, in Southeast Queens. We tried an approach that was heavy on outreach, education, mass distribution, concentrated testing and enforcement wherever needed. And that worked. In this instance, we saw this problem grow, tried the same strategies, tried more enforcement. It was not turning the tide the way it needed to, because you can only enforce in so many places at so many times. We're now at the point where we need restrictions, hopefully only for a few weeks, to really turn the tide here.
And the mayor explained the school closings he's announced.
We chose to close the schools out of an abundance of caution. Thankfully, in our school system, including in the affected zip codes, Tier 1, Tier 2, we are not seeing any unusual problems, anything out of the ordinary in our schools, thank God. And we continue to do testing outside of schools and in schools in those affected zip codes, testing teachers, staff, watching for problems. I'll give you an example. Just the last few days, we've gotten 1,351 test results from 35 schools in those nine top zip codes, and only two positive tests among the 1,351 results we've gotten so far. So, our educators, our staff, school communities are doing a great job. They're doing the right thing. They're being smart about things. Folks understand the hand washing, the hand sanitizer, the social distancing, the face mask. If sick, they're staying home. People are doing this the right way, and it's proven by the testing we're seeing at our schools. We're going to keep that testing going in the 13 zip codes on the watch list, constantly moving from school to school each day to keep a clear picture on what's going on.
But the mayor remained vague on how long this new lockdown will last.
If we all do this right, which we did before in much tougher circumstances, we contain this problem to a limited part of the city for a limited period of time. Then we reopen in those places and keep moving forward. If we do it wrong, it keeps spreading into surrounding zip codes and then endangers the whole city. We cannot let that happen. So everyone has to be part of the solution.
Mayor de Blasio. And that's the WBAI News for Tuesday, October 6, 2020. The news is produced with Rebecca Miles and Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson from New York City. I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for listening.
Day, October 7th. Beginning at 9 p.m. Eastern, 8 p.m. Central, and 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on your radio station. Coming to you from Pacifica's sister station in New York, WBAI.